You know what, though? The hereafter is a hustle. We want it now. And let's get a couple things straight, just a little side note. The burden of the brutalized is not to comfort the bystander. That's not our job. All right, stop with all that. If you have a critique for the resistance, for our resistance, then you better have an established record of critique of our oppression. If you have no interest in equal rights for black people, then do not make suggestions to those who do. Sit down. We've been floating this country on credit for centuries, yo. And we're done watching and waiting while this invention called whiteness uses and abuses us, burying black people out of sight and out of mind while extracting our culture, our dollars, our entertainment like oil, black gold, ghettoizing and demeaning our creations, then stealing them, gentrifying our genius, and then trying us on like costumes before discarding our bodies like rinds of strange fruit. The thing is that just because we're magic doesn't mean we're not real.
Actor and activist Jesse Williams speaking at the BET Awards after he received the Humanitarian Award. And that does it for today's show. If you'd like a copy of the DVD, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Has job openings. Go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Nardina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Juan Carlos Davila, and Pedro Rodriguez, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godarz. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is more talk radio with guest host Doug McVeigh. Today's guest is journalist, author, and editor-in-chief at Freedom Leaf Magazine, Steve Bloom. We'll talk about pot culture and celebrity stoners.
Tune in to KBOO for a 25-hour fundraising extravaganza of special programming and community celebration. Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman recently spoke in Portland on Democracy Now! 20 years covering the movements changing America. KBOO will broadcast this inspiring speech at 10 a.m. Again, that's 6 a.m. on July 14th through 7 a.m. on July 15th to support your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio will launch our new Production Room 3 Saturday, July 9th from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. at KBOO Studios. This event is open to the public and everyone is invited. We will be offering tours of the station as well as tours of the new production room, which is a state-of-the-art interview and editing room. Come test out the equipment and make your own recording. Join us for refreshments and a reception at 4 p.m. to thank the donors, foundations, and volunteers who have made this project possible. Again, that's the Production Room 3 Celebration and Launch Party, Saturday, July 9th, from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
Join us Sunday night, July 10th, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. for Soul Music and Politics. We will celebrate the life and music of Mr. Donny Hathaway. We will also deconstruct the at-large voting process in Multnomah County and Portland, Oregon, that keeps the status quo power elite in power. Sunday night for Soul Music and Politics, July 10th, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. on KBOO.
Keep on walking tall. Hold your head up high.
Good morning. Good morning, Portland. Happy 4th of July. And welcome to More Talk Radio on your community radio station, KBOO, 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. Well, you know where you're listening. My name is Doug McVeigh. I am sitting in for our regular hosts, Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. They have the day off. We'll be back next week. So you stuck with me, but that's all right, because we've got a good guest for us today. Now, unless you have been hiding under a rock for the last few years, and well, frankly, even if you have, you must have noticed that marijuana's all over the news. States legalizing, more medical, the programs changing, members of Congress giving out awards to pot growers. I mean, it's a different world than it used to be. Marijuana's everywhere. And the marijuana media, at one time there was a magazine, High Times. Then a second one came along, Cannabis Culture. But nowadays, well, those two are still around, and then there's Dope, and there's Skunk, and there's Ladybud, and there's, then there's talk about web radio, where there are actually three or four streaming services devoted to marijuana. And then there's a radio station in Denver that started up that's all about weed. It's everywhere. Now, marijuana journalism, as I say, there's a lot of outlets out there. There have been some around for a little while. And our guest today is someone who has been part of this marijuana journalism thing for quite a long time. I first met him when he was a news editor at High Times magazine, way, way back in the late 1980s. And he, full disclosure, I have written for him in that capacity, and in fact, in the last few years, I've written a couple of pieces for his blog, which is called celebstoner.com, and for a magazine he has. He's the editor-in-chief at something called Freedom Leaf. And we're on the phone right now with that gentleman, Steve Bloom. Steve, how you doing this morning?
I'm great, Doug. Great to be with you.
My friend, thank you so much. It's good of you to give up your holiday morning to hang out and chat. How's your 4th of July going?
Well, it just started, so it's kind of quiet, but it'll start getting louder as the day goes on.
No doubt, no doubt. I want to talk to you about music and movies and sports and all kinds of stuff, because that's kind of what you do, right? I mean, Celeb Stoner is that's the entertainment and marijuana blog.
Well, I like to think so. That's sort of an outgrowth of my work at High Times, my book, Pot Culture, The A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life. So, you know, I tend to see myself as one of the foremost experts on stoner movies and marijuana music, things in the culture, where it's happening on TV, movies, sports. That's kind of what Celeb Stoner veers off into, and just generally the celebrities who advocate in favor of marijuana. So we kind of follow what they're up to and add more and more onto the list of celeb stoners when, you know, they start doing some important things. You know, Whoopi Goldberg or people like that who've come along in the last few years and become, you know, celeb stoners.
And folks, you can join us as we join us in the conversation as we chat about pot culture, celebrity stoners, the hemp movement, and all that kinds of stuff. Phone lines are open. You can join us at 503-231-8187. Again, that number, 503-231-8187. Let's back up a minute. Tell our listeners about pot culture. What is pot culture?
You mean in a general idea or the book itself?
Well, a general idea.
Well, you know, Cannabis Culture was the name of a magazine and a website that you just referred to up in Canada. You know, there's this whole pervasive element of marijuana where it covers all aspects of society. It's not just something you get high and, you know, get into the plant itself. It leads to other things of interest. Opens doors, you know, to music and movies and television and thought and writing, science and all kinds of things. So it kind of, you know, it depends of your interest, but most people are into movies and music. And when most people know that when you smoke marijuana, it kind of gets you a little bit more deeper into whatever music you're listening to, and probably the same with movies and probably the same with just everything. And everything intensifies somewhat in a good way when you're under the influence of marijuana. So whatever you're watching, listening to, doing has a deeper significance, and maybe you have a greater understanding of it all. So, you know, I, as a music journalist at the start of my career, and then I veered off into working at High Times because I knew an editor up there who invited me to do some work there, gradually until I was, you know, hired as an editor. I, as Steve Hager used to say, who was the editor-in-chief at the time, he noticed that I was always putting music articles into the news section. And he thought, well, you know, I guess he didn't know that much about my background as a music journalist. And, you know, it dawned on him at some point that I'd probably be better suited to be like a music editor or an entertainment editor or a culture editor at High Times rather than the news editor. So news editor was really great for me to learn the basics of what was going on in marijuana activism and politics. But, you know, it kind of wasn't exactly the thing that I was most into. So I was able to combine both of my interests. Now, learning about High Times and the marijuana world as I kind of got more and more involved there, and then bringing my music journalism background into High Times. And so that's when, in like the early 90s, I started doing a lot of music coverage in the magazine, and we started putting a lot of musicians on the cover in the magazine, and Cypress Hill and the Black Crowes and 311 and Blues Traveler and Spin Doctors and all these groups from back then. Fishbone, you know, Snoop Dogg, Ozzy Osbourne. We had so many, Ice Cube, we had so many, you know, great musicians on the cover around that time. And, you know, they were all lining up to be in High Times, so it was sort of exciting for me. I didn't even realize that there was that deep of a connection between the musicians and the magazine. But it was one of the requests that a lot of the musicians were making to their publicists, can you get me an interview with High Times? So not only were we knocking on doors, but they were knocking on the High Times door. So there were just so many opportunities back then to interview. So it was a great time for me to take my music journalism experience and bring it into High Times, and sort of it all kind of came around for me.
Music journalism, I just got to brag because you're one of the only people I know who's actually met James Brown.
I got to know him very well.
Yeah, it's do you have any anecdotes?
Well, I never smoked pot with James Brown. He wasn't into that, but I think he actually was on his own. He would kind of lace pot with PCP, of all things, but I wasn't around for any of that. Never smoked a joint with PCP with James Brown. But other than that, that was, you know, predating my years at High Times. I interviewed James Brown in 1979, and I got into his music in the like early 70s during the Great Funk period. And then as I became a music journalist, and my focus was jazz and R&B and soul and disco at the time, and I kind of got into music journalism that way. First of all, that was my interest, but also everybody's writing about rock and punk, and, you know, and I kind of came in the door through another way, and that's how I sort of got in my assignments, because, you know, I guess not that many people were asking for those sort of assignments at the places where I was writing. So I was able to sort of get into Downbeat and Rolling Stone even, you know, by covering that music, whereas everybody else was covering rock. So I was sort of the soul guy. And so that was my interest, and then came around the opportunity to interview James Brown. I was assigned by my editor at the Soho Weekly News back in New York when my first place I really did most of my early writing, Peter Ochiagrosso, and they had an opportunity to interview James Brown. I guess it came through the record company, Polydor, you know, knocking on their door saying, you know, do you want to do an interview? So I'm the soul guy, so he sends me over to do an interview with James Brown, and it was really a strange occasion. The whole thing, you know, went awry from the beginning. I went to the record company. James Brown wasn't there. He blew up the interview. I asked him where he's staying. He was staying at the Sherry Netherland Hotel, so I walked over there, and I kind of was hoping to run into him. As it turns out, you know, not too much longer after I was waiting in the lobby, a whole entourage came in with James Brown. I went over to one of the guys who appeared to be a manager and told him that I was supposed to have an interview, and next thing you know, I'm, you know, sitting in a room by myself, and the guy says, just wait here, and then James Brown barges in, and he was in no mood to do the interview. You know, and who are you? So that was the beginning of my introduction to James Brown. And he just basically did about 10 minutes and then just stopped the interview and went off on a kind of a rant and then walked out on me. And it's like, wow, you know, there goes my story. And so the manager comes in and says, you know, don't worry, he's not in a great mood. And he, like, took me for dinner and cajoled me for hours with James Brown's story. He says, come back at 9 in the morning. I came back at 9 in the morning. It was a different guy. He was getting his hair done. He was talking to all kinds of people on the phone. He was gregarious. He gave me a terrific interview, which continued throughout the day, which included a limousine ride. So I really bonded with him that day. And then the next time I saw him, he was having a problem with the record company. And of all people, Bill Kunstler was representing him at a press conference. And I went to the conference. A lot of people were there. You know, I just got there maybe 5 minutes late, and maybe it seemed like James Brown was holding it up for me. And when I show up, he gave me a hug in front of everybody. He loved the article. So and later he says, you quoted me, he says, just right, you know. He says, and so he was, from that point on, we were sort of friendly, and I was had a door open to see him anytime. And most of the time then, he there wasn't that big of a crowd, the media crowd, to, you know, to see him. So I was able to sort of see him during intermissions and before or after shows and do a lot of interviews with him then, up until about 84. So he got arrested. And then I would see him a few other times. He would play B.B. King's in New York. I had a great last, you know, before he died, about 6 months before he died, I saw him at B.B. King's, and he gave me one of those great James Brown hugs, and the last time I saw him. But I really had a great relationship, but he called me the redheaded booger. I'm not making this stuff up.
Man. And from there, you got into the pot world. My goodness. Now, let's talk about something fun here. Let's talk about music. We didn't talk about James Brown. Let's talk more music and the and marijuana thing. Did you just see Ziggy Marley or Steve Marley?
Oh, it was Steven, yeah.
Steven?
I saw him the other night.
Right on. I saw you tweeting something about the Melody Makers, though.
Well, you know, I was in the bus before the concert, and I've always been friendly with all the Marleys, thanks to, you know, my years at High Times. I was the liaison to the Marley family, and kind of made myself the liaison. Nobody was, so I became it. So I got to know everybody back then. I retained, you know, friendships with all of them post High Times. I hadn't seen Steven in a while, and just knocked on the door at the bus outside before the show, and, you know, came in, and he was pretty mellow, just hanging out, doing a few things. Had kids all over around because he travels with so many of his kids, and we just chatted, you know, for a few minutes. Showed him my new magazine, and I just kind of asked him about the Melody Makers, because, you know, it's him and Ziggy and Sadella and Sharon, you know, the four of them, you know, and they haven't really performed again as a group for many years, probably a good 20 years. So I just asked if he has any intention of getting back together with the Melody Makers, and he said, you know, yeah, you know, they've been talking about it. So maybe he was just humoring me, or maybe it's true. Sadella runs their business now, the Marley, House of Marley, and now the Marley Natural as well, which is their marijuana brand. So she's kind of busy not being a musician or a singer, whereas Steven and Ziggy are constantly out there touring. So, you know, it's a little hard for them to really be involved with the family business, but they certainly can, you know, if they decide, you know, to, you know, to reunite the Melody Makers. Would really be great, because they have so much great music. And they don't really play much of it. You know, when you see Steven Marley like I did the other night, it's a mixture of his own music and Bob Marley music, and he kind of weaves in Marley songs, and Ziggy does the same thing. But Ziggy may play some Melody Maker songs, I'm forgetting, but Steven doesn't, or at least didn't the other night. So that music's a little bit forgotten, you know, and when you go see them, you see their current stuff, which they've won Grammy Awards for. I'm referring to, you know, Ziggy, Steven, and Damien, and then they mix in Bob songs, you know, and that makes it a great Marley evening of music.
Nice. Now, folks, remember, you can join in the conversation. Just pick up your phone and press the digits 503-231-8187. I'm Doug McVeigh, sitting in for Cecil and Celeste. My guest is Steve Bloom, editor-in-chief at Freedom Leaf magazine, and celeb stoner. And let's talk movies for a moment, shall we? Because this is summer, and I still haven't seen any movies. I don't even know what's playing. What kind of good stoner movies are out there this summer?
You know, for this summer right now, I'm not quite sure if any of the movies that would be, you know, qualify as the stoner movies for the season so far, or, you know, or even in the theaters, you know, at this point. But, you know, mostly it's, you know, the big budge popcorn style movies that are out right now. But early in the season, you know, you've had a lot of sort of offbeat stoner movies. I guess the biggest one would be Neighbors 2. That's not offbeat. That's a, you know, big budget. I'm not sure if Neighbors 2 is still in the theaters. It might be, because it's such a wide release. You know, that's, you know, with Seth Rogen, anything with Seth Rogen, you know, qualifies as almost like Cheech and Chong these days. Anything with Seth Rogen is going to be a stoner movie in some respect. Maybe a couple of few movies. Some of his movies haven't been, but so many are. And this one certainly is, you know, so I kind of recommend that. That's kind of a cool one. You know, it's been a soft season for stoner movies so far, but there's been a couple of, you know, this Miles Ahead movie about Miles Davis, and there's the, I'm trying to see what else, just trying to recall what some of the movies are, like, this year that have been out so far, you know, that might be worth seeing, you know, like, I mean, just at least checking on your, you know, on your demand or whatever it is. I like Popstar, which is probably out right now. The Andy Samberg movie is really a great spoof, great send up of like a Bieber sort of documentary, and there is marijuana theme in that storyline, and there's just a good scene. It kind of builds to, you know, one of the characters, you know, moves to Colorado. I'll just leave it at that. So those two movies, I would say, for sure. You know, Richard Linklater had his update of Dazed and Confused came out this year, called Everybody Wants Some, which is basically a baseball movie. It's a college baseball movie. And so, it goes from high school to college, but a whole bunch of new characters. And the movie didn't do very well, kind of like Dazed and Confused. Nobody knew who anybody was in that movie. Maybe some stars will come out of this one. There's definitely some stoner stuff in that movie. But, you know, there hasn't been that much so far this year, you know, that I've been kind of zeroing in on. There's also been a documentary called Rolling Papers about the cannabis. That was pretty good. But you know, there's always something out there. There's always something to look for in the movies.
What makes a stoner movie? I mean, is it the marijuana theme? Is it the actor? How do you define it?
Ways to, you know, define it, but to me, at the most basic level, is the drug content in a movie. If there's actual drug use in a movie, in any form, that generally qualifies it to be a stoner movie. Now, if it's very fleeting and a simple pass of a joint, you know, during one scene that lasts 5 seconds, it probably is not a stoner movie per se, but it's just a movie that has, you know, one, you know, small marijuana scene in it. But, you know, it generally, you know, if it's more, you know, intense marijuana use or other drugs. Now, any drug, you know, now the stoner movie, a lot of people think is just a comedy. I don't really see it as that. I see it as comedy and drama and fantasy and documentary. It could be any kind of musical type movie that has a drug theme running through it. So the idea of the stoner movie, usually, oh, this Cheech and Chong or The Big Lebowski or, all kinds of, you know, stoner movies that have been out, the Super Troopers and things like that. They're just a lot of big laughs, great funny movies that all kind of stem from the Cheech and Chong model of the two guys. You know, it's changing a little bit, you know, but still the two guys may be a little on the dopey side. Not so much now. Harold and Kumar are a lot smarter, you know, but who use marijuana and go on some sort of big adventure. That's generally what happens. You know, the Friday movies, there's some adventure or just adventure within the lives of the characters. Maybe not a real big scheme, but something is happening, you know, through the storyline and maybe even mundane, but the marijuana makes it sort of interesting. So there's that, but then there's the other side of it, you know, which is like, so you have the Cheech and Chong model of the funny stoner movie, and then you have the more serious, you know, model, which is sort of, I take it back to Easy Rider. So, you know, whereas you have, say, Up in Smoke as the, you know, really the beginning of the stoner movie era for more of the humorous kind of stoner movie, the comedy, and then you have predating that, you know, was the more serious movie, because obviously it went back to anti-drug stuff, going back to the 30s and then taking it into the 60s when, you know, now, you know, the themes were changing. You know, the counterculture was coming in and the anti-heroes were using drugs. And so Easy Rider is really where this is the real kickoff or the starting point of, you know, the druggy drama, you know, where it's not played for laughs. This is a serious story that has a lot of, you know, marijuana and other drugs running through it. So there's that. And then there's the movies that you just like to watch stoned. You know, and so when I wrote my book, Reefer Movie Madness, The Ultimate Stoner Film Guide, with Shirley Halpern, who I also wrote Pop Culture with, we debated this a lot. You know, what is a stoner movie? And I was more on the side of the literal definition, and she was more on the side of, you know, what do you like to watch stoned? And that could be a lot of movies, you know. So we kind of broadened out the definition of that for our book, and, you know, had about 600 movies in that book. And but, you know, it could be a more narrow or it could be a broader definition depending on your opinion.
Movies are a good segue, I think, because we just learned this week that the state of California will officially be voting on something called the Adult Use of Marijuana Act. It's a sort of a kind of a legalization initiative, partial legalization. It's they finally settled on Proposition 64. To call it, and so California in just a few months will be voting on whether to legalize. Now, what do you think, presuming it passes, what do you think that's going to do as far as our entertainment industry? It's no longer the nudge, nudge, wink, wink, I've got my medical card. Now it's, there's a store right down the street. Do you think it's going to make a difference?
Well, it'll just play into storylines that much more. You know, medical marijuana has been very, very popular in movies and television as a device, you know, as a backdrop, you know, for some sort of storyline or some sort of joke, you know. Oftentimes the joke, you know, I'm getting medical marijuana, ha ha, you know. Bad teacher, you know, Cameron Diaz, you know, she's kind of caught by one of her students. She's smoking in her car, and she rolls down the window, and she kind of chastises the girl for bothering. She says, and by the way, it's medical marijuana. So that's an easy out. But, you know, back to, you know, AUMA, A-U-M-A, I just want to say that I'm for it. You know, there's a lot of people out there in California who want to be against it, and they did it before, and they you know, succeeded in losing in 2010 by being super divisive. When Prop 19 didn't pass, but you know, here's another chance. Now, I was for, you know, the legalization in Ohio, which was very controversial. I'm for, you know, almost all legalization efforts. I haven't seen one yet that I'm not for. Now, I don't live in California. I don't live in Ohio, so it's not going to impact my life the way it will if you live there. So I understand why people get much more deeper into the details than I do. I don't get into the details that much because I don't live there. It doesn't matter that much to me. All that matters to me is more legalization. It's a perception, you know, for the world, you know, that we're expanding beyond four states. So, okay, we missed an opportunity in Ohio. I didn't buy the argument, the anti-argument that big marijuana was taking over. Yeah, Oscar Robertson, the basketball player, big marijuana? I don't think so. You know, he's a small player out there with some money, businessman who put money up. Or Nick Lachey, you know, the guy, you know, the singer. You know, these are not big marijuana. You know, real estate interests and stuff like that were not big marijuana, in my opinion, you know. So I thought it was really false, you know, charge against a lot of these people who had put up the money. Obviously, they said they wanted the opportunity to compete for the licenses on the back end instead of it being front-loaded and the investors getting guarantees. So I understand that. You know, it didn't seem to be very fair. But, you know, it's not that fair even in the selection process, even when they pick them. You know, you put up a lot of money and only a few people get selected and it becomes a monopoly anyway. So pick your, you know, your poison in terms of how you're going to have a monopoly, but they're monopolies. So so I was for Ohio, and I'm for AUMA in California. The more, the better, and I hope, you know, five states pass legalization this year, plus Florida, for medical marijuana. The more, the better. The more pushing the envelope and getting, you know, marijuana, you know, legalized federally. It's, you know, that's what we need to do. So I'm really in favor of it. You know, that's all there is to it. And I've been supporting it through Freedom Leaf, and I've been seeing all the pros and cons, but I don't see that much negative on it. I mean, maybe you could tell me why some people who's a marijuana advocate would not vote for AUMA.
Not really, no. I mean, there will obviously be some changes in the medical market. That's almost a given. It's happened in Washington. It's happened in Colorado. It's happening here in Oregon. And that's, I mean, the question isn't will it happen. It's more like how will those changes take effect, and how will patients fare afterward? And as long as we approach it, I think as long as we approach it from that standpoint, I think we can move forward, you know, and create a good system. It's, you know, it's not the best system ever, probably, but then again, that's, well, of course not. But it's a start. No, I was trying to stay neutral on Ohio because I had concerns over the monopoly thing being written into law, but at the same time, it's a legalization initiative, and reform is a good thing. So, but as far as the AUMA, you know, I'm in favor of Prop 64. It's now Prop 60. It was Prop 63. Now it's the Secretary of State changed their mind again, and it's Prop 64. One of the things, your journalism over the years, there's High Times and the rest, you've been an activist as a drug policy reformer and journalist. I mean, journalism is your main, is your bread and butter. But you often use your journalism for political, to talk about political causes. And you're an activist. How do you feel those combine? How do you feel about that?
Well, I had a great opportunity to become an activist journalist or an advocate when I started working at High Times. I hadn't really done that before. I didn't write with a kind of a slant. I'm not a news writer per se, where everything has to be balanced down the middle, but that's more or less how you're trained, So I did get trained that way, going back to high school and college, but, I kind of veered off that. And so finding a way to be an advocate and a journalist at the same time, I lucked out in getting a job at High Times. There's not too many places you can really do that. So you wear those hats. But journalism comes first for me, activism second. That's what I am. I'm a trained journalist from high school on. I started this at a very young age. I was on a path at a very early age in my life to, be a writer, be a journalist, be an author. So all that comes first. And the activism, that kind of stems from, coming, through the 60s, being into the anti-war movement in the 60s, having gone to a lot of rallies, even getting arrested in 72 in Washington, D.C. at the Pentagon. I have a lot of experience with that. And then, I was kind of looking for, I think, something to get into. I was always very much into environmental issues, but had never really jumped aboard any campaign or, done any Greenpeace or, anything dramatic. I just was a believer. Nothing, going through the 70s into the 80s, through the Reagan era, nothing really kind of grabbed me to the point where I was involved with any political cause, other than my own personal belief systems. And then I got the job at High Times in late 88, and that really opened up this whole window to this world of marijuana activism that I really didn't know much about. I was kind of blasé, I think, about it because we grew up in New York, decrim. It was hard to get arrested for pot in New York in the 70s. And, there was the rallies and stuff, which I never went to, and the smoke-ins in Washington Square Park. And there was High Times, which I never read or hardly read, even though, as it turned out, I learned later was really great journalistic vehicle in the 70s, as was so many other magazines like Rolling Stone and New Times, or you can name a lot of cool magazines back in High Times, really part of that era of really great, fearless journalism, in the 70s that I kind of grew up on, but I kind of missed it. For whatever reason, I wasn't paying attention to High Times, and of course I learned it later when I worked there. I mean, I only bought a couple of copies before I ever worked at High Times. So yeah, getting over there, to High Times, and then kind of, learning, very quickly, what was going on in the marijuana world. I met you and I met the whole normal crowd, and that really opened big doors for me. And I always say that when I started there, this is the old days now, still typewriters and, pre-computers, and everybody wrote their letters, handwritten letters, and I would get this basket or a box full of letters and stuff to read through. That was like my introduction to High Times. You're the news editor now. I'd work 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off because I was part-time until I became full-time a few years later. And then I just read through all these letters, and they were just horror stories of arrests and this and that. And, so that's how I kind of learned. I didn't realize how bad it was out there. I really didn't. That really opened my eyes. And then you just get into it. You've decided, okay, I can be an activist too. I can be a journalist and an activist too. Wow, wear a couple of hats. And a few other things, because I did the Hempelation albums for Normal, which were, I was producing, records, and I put on award shows for High Times, the Stonies and the Doobies, and I did events every year at South by Southwest, so I could be a producer too. So it's kind of fun. High Times allowed me to wear a lot of hats.
By the way, better mention this is KBOO Radio in Portland, 90.7 FM. This is More Talk Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh, sitting in for our regular hosts, Cecil and Celeste. You can join us in conversation at 503-231-8187. My guest is Steve Bloom, the editor-in-chief of Freedom Leaf Magazine and a longtime journalist and activist on hemp marijuana, the pot culture guy. I know everybody out there is probably just waking up and getting ready to go down to the Waterfront Blues Festival, which will be broadcasting here on KBOO starting at noon. Some terrific music. Oh my gosh, Steve, last night, Dr. John. Ah, it was
not a night tripper.
Oh my heaven, it was tremendous, and a bunch of other good music too. That was it's brilliant. And right down there on the waterfront, low admission, and it's a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank. It's some good. We do some good stuff out here, even if it is West Coast. Let's see. Looking at my list of things to talk to you about. Oh my heavens! You know what? Rio, the Olympics, the potential disaster that is the Rio Olympics are about to start, and one of the top celeb sports stoners in the world is going there to compete. That's Michael Phelps. I was looking through the site, noticing a lot of football players getting in trouble for marijuana this season. One NBA, I didn't see anybody from baseball. Celebrity. Yeah. What's happening in the sports world?
Well, there's so much happening in football. You know, there's the players' revolt against the NFL. You know, it's slowly, you know, percolating with it. Started with retired players who are realizing that marijuana is better for them than all the opiates they've been prescribed forever. And they're trying to get off their opiate habits with the help of marijuana. It's a controversial thing, but still, you know, they seem to, a lot of them, like Jim McMahon, you know, the Super Bowl quarterback from the Bears, you know, is saying that marijuana is really turning his life around, you know. And so there's a lot of, I interviewed a guy named Kyle Turley, who also has the Gridiron Cannabis Coalition, and, you know, he says the same thing. It's really changed their lives dramatically in that, you know, when they're on all these other drugs, oftentimes they can be sort of violent too and have rage and issues, and marijuana sort of calms them down, you know, and helps kind of balance off their lives, you know, which has sort of gone off the deep end for a lot of these guys after they leave, you know, football, after they leave, you know, their careers. And now you're having some guys, you know, who are actually saying, you know, who are in the league now, who are actually saying that they you know, are in favor of medical marijuana. So so it's kind of popping up, you know, within the league itself, not just the retired players. That's one aspect of it, and that's all this big issue over CTE, you know, the concussion syndrome and the brain damage that a lot of these players have that they play with and they have afterwards, and many die young. So then there's just the general issue of drug use among in sports. But football is the reason, I think, you know, that there's so many more issues in football, whether players getting arrested or failing drug tests and often being suspended because they violated the substance abuse policy that the league has, which is very strict. You know, this happens in, you know, big numbers both in professional and college football because there are so many players per team. You know, there's 50-plus players per team. So basketball, you have 12 players, I think, per team. Baseball, 25, 26. Hockey, whatever, 15, 20, whatever you have on your bench. You know, there's a big squad, and so the numbers really just add up. A lot of football players are African-American. Most of the arrests and suspensions are for players who are African-American. Just reported the other day that Johnny Manziel, you know, the quarterback, you know, who's kind of had been having all kinds of trials and tribulations in his first few years in football, high draft pick, you know, he just loves to party, this guy. And so he just got busted because of a variety of things that he's done, you know, it's both personal issues and drug-related. But they have toned down the, you know, they kind of, it's not quite as strict as it was a couple of years ago. The NFL has shifted their policy somewhat, you know, for the amount that you have to have in your system. You know, it's got to be more now than it was in the past. They give you a few more breaks in terms of how many tests you have to fail before they're going to start throwing the book at you. But basically, it's still happening. I just reported 10 players right now are on suspension or going into suspensions for the start of the season. They just announced several players with 10-game suspensions, or there's some year-long suspensions. I mean, in basketball, I was really surprised that O.J. Mayo, and basketball's pretty liberal when it comes to suspending, and you know, the NFL is very strict, that O.J. Mayo got a 2-year suspension for, you know, multiple violations that are going back to mostly performance-enhancing drugs in his case. But most of these suspensions are due to marijuana being in the system. There's a couple of times when it could be amphetamines or Adderall. Some of the players seem to like Adderall. So then they also take, you know, there could be PEs, PD, you know, performance-enhancing drugs, that they are taking these, you know, nutritional supplements and things that sometimes have things in it they don't even realize are against. I mean, just like what happened to Sharapova. You know, she got busted for a Latvian, PED that wasn't on the schedule until they just added it, and she kind of, oops, you know, didn't realize and kind of kept taking it until it was too late. And she got a two-year suspension. So, you know, things like they make mistakes. You know, they've been on something that was okay, and then they ban it because they find that, well, it really is a PED. But what I'm talking about mostly with the players in football and mostly football, basketball, and some basketball, college and professional football, is they have a lot of suspensions. The league usually will go into this season with 25 or more players suspended on some kind of drug violation. So, you know, they're calling on the NFL to really cut it back, you know, and just be, you know, but, you know, NFL's, you know, been on the hot seat for the last couple of years in terms of how they've handled a lot of different issues, assaults, and that's where really some of it started. And now there's a lot more pressure being placed on the NFL to really adjust its drug policy and to perhaps, especially in the legal states, allow players to use, at least for medicinal purposes. So I don't know. You know, Goodell, who's the commissioner, doesn't seem to really be interested in changing much. And so I think it might take a new commissioner, but he's locked in at his $30 million a year salary. So it's a little hard to get him to change the policy in the league. But it's an ongoing issue, especially in football.
Indeed, and I know that, you know, alcohol used to be a big problem with athletes. I mean, you mentioned Jim McMahon. Alcohol was not his friend towards the end of the career, and so if the whole safer argument and the notion that people will prefer to try legal marijuana rather than legal alcohol, the kind of violence that's associated with alcohol use, then might diminish. I mean, I don't. And what do you think about the safer argument or the idea that people will substitute?
I mean, I think it's not so much. I don't think that's really the argument. I think the argument is that if alcohol is legal, why not marijuana? You know, and look at the numbers, look at the obvious, you know, the damage that alcohol causes and the lack of, you know, damage that marijuana causes. You know, by comparison, it's not even comparable, really. So, it's brilliant. You know, Mason Tvert and Safer, you know, that's a brilliant argument, and it's worked, and it's got a lot of people to think about that dynamic. And for me, that's not really would be the way I'd present it, but I understand why it's being presented that way and how it works as an argument. It's just not the way I generally would present, you know, why we should legal, because it's better for you than alcohol. Well, that's not my argument, but I understand how that works.
And again, of course, our phone number 503-231-8187. If you'd like to join the conversation, you're welcome to. And I'll even take your call. Probably. You're one. We've known each other for years, and we've worked together for a long time. One of the people when we were you. At High Times helped to give some early exposure to a group of people called the Cannabis Action Network, Maria Farrow and Monica Pratt and Debbie Goldsberry. Now Debbie is one of the leaders in the California marijuana industry and internationally around as a leader in the whole hemp movement. One of the big books that came out of the late 80s that is still influential today, written by the late Jack Herer, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. While you were there at High Times, you and Hager and the folks at High Times really did a lot to promote the Emperor and to promote Hemp Tour. You and the High Times crew were on Hemp Tour quite a bit. Did you ever think back in those days when Jack had taken over your living room and sleeping on your couch, did you ever think back in those days that we'd be here now talking about hemp growing all over the United States legally, about states legalizing and such?
I mean, I'm not that big on forecasting the future, but, you know, you have to figure that, you know, in 25 years we would accomplish something. And a lot of it is thanks to Jack, and Cannabis Action Network, which was sort of an offshoot of Normal. It was sort of the women's movement. Now you see Women Grow, and you've seen the Normal, women's organization. But that was then. There was a feeling that it was mostly men who were kind of making decisions in the marijuana, world. And the Jack Herers and the Dana Beals and the Ben Mazels and on the Normal side, Keith Strop, and it was, mostly men, running things. And here came along a bunch of deadheads, essentially, who met at shows. I met Maria Farrow when she was touring with Jack Herer, and so that was how she got involved, because she knew Jack from California. She grew up in L.A., and she knew Jack's son, and so she went off on the road with him. And Debbie Goldsberry was going to school in Illinois, and she was, getting things going with Ben Mazel, and they were, hitting campuses and doing little rallies and stuff. So Jack came out and kind of met them, and other people kind of converged, in the Midwest, and that was really the birth of Hemp Tour. And so High Times kind of dovetailed into that via me, my interest, and I was a news editor then, so, I figured, well, this is where the news is at, this is the scene, so I kind of went and followed that around. That kind of took us to Ann Arbor. I had a really fun Hemp Tour run of going to East Lansing, Ann Arbor, and then kind of going to Kent and Flint and a few other places with Jack, on tour. It was a lot of fun. And so, that whole group of people who were meeting at dead shows and then hanging out in my living room in Brooklyn and, and hanging out at the Butternut House where you lived in D.C. and hanging out in maybe a few other places around the country, who would take them in. But it sort of was birthed, their movement was sort of birthed, at those places. And I was sort of peripherally involved in sort of advising in some respect. But they really were on their own mission, to, set up an organization that was female-based, that they had more say. And it was really, I think, probably Debbie, pushing that envelope, Debbie Goldsberry, for the most part. And look who, rose to the top, Debbie Goldsberry. I mean, Maria Farrow, is not involved. She lives in New York. She works in retail. Monica was working for
Families Against Mandatory Minimums. I think she's still there.
So there, I haven't heard from Monica in a while, and I don't really hear much about FAM these days, but they're one of the original groups. And Missy Hendrickson and Sarah, I always forget her last name, who was on the cover of the High Times issue that had Debbie, Maria, Monica, and Sarah on the cover back in, 1991. Those were the women of CAN, and then you and me and Steve D'Angelo and Jack and others, and we're all kind of advisors, I mean, you were probably more of an official original member of CAN, and maybe I could call myself that too, but, we were sort of advisors. We were just kind of helping it, get off the ground. It was great. And now Debbie's, been a major player in the Bay Area scene for years through Berkeley Patients Group and the Magnolia Wellness, where she is now, and I know she's working on another thing with Amoeba Records, which is really fascinating if they can get a license for a dispensary on Telegraph in Berkeley and combine, record sales and marijuana, music and marijuana. It's the perfect combination. So she's working on that, so hopefully that comes to fruition. They're hoping to get a license. So, obviously done some great things, and that was the forerunner to what we're seeing now. Now you see articles left and right, with the Women Grow theme and women in the business and this and that. It all started with, with CAN.
And in doing the early days, it was going around hitting some of the different tours that were there. It was further a couple of the different concert events that were going around the country. We'd be able to get booths at. Are there still concert tours happening? I feel like I'm so old. I don't even know anymore. Are there things like that around? It used to be like the Lollapalooza and Horde and things like that.
Yeah, Vans is still traveling around. I mean, Vans, the Horde Tour, not the Horde Tour, the Warped Tour, I'm sorry, is still, the Vans Warped Tour is still traveling around. They're amazingly doing that for years after year. But most of those tours that I was really into back then, and I was covering all of them for High Times, and they've disappeared. The Horde, Lollapalooza is a standalone, festival in Chicago. It doesn't tour anymore. Ozfest was around at that time. The Horde was one of my favorites. I mean, I was at the original Horde tour, which was, they did it really different back then. That was, it was Blues Traveler and Spin Doctors, Widespread Panic and Colonel Bruce Hampton and Aquarium Rescue Unit, and Fish. So I guess like probably Colonel Bruce opens, and then instead of there being a break, you know, the members of Widespread Panic start walking on stage, and they start playing together, and they play some song together and jam, and then Colonel Bruce's people kind of leave, and then Widespread take over, and they finish the set. Same thing happened with Blues Traveler and Spin Doctor. Let's say Spin's opened, and Blues Traveler comes on, and they play a song together, and then Spins leave, and Blues Traveler finish, you know, a set. And then Fish had the top billing, you know, even though they weren't that well known then, because it was 1992, I think, or 91 even, but it was really great. So now, you know, there's not so much that as much as package tours now, where you get 311s constantly touring, you know, they always have their summer tour. Slightly Stupid is kind of, you know, has sort of the Sublime crowd in a sense, you know, even though Sublime is back with the new singer, Sublime with Rome, but, you know, but they kind of, that Southern California ska, reggae kind of scene. They travel around every summer. I see them all the time. So, I mean, you catch the groups individually as they travel, and they do nice package summer tours. But these bigger tours, I think they've kind of, you know, they've been replaced by festivals. And even the festivals are starting to wane a little bit because, you know, after a while, maybe people get tired of the same thing or the same place. So some festivals, like Gathering of the Vibes, which is one of the original festivals in the East Coast here that was dedicated to the Grateful Dead scene, they're taking the year off. And, you know, so, but it merged off into a lot of festivals, obviously Bonnaroo and, you know, they probably kind of, instead of touring around all summer, you have one big summer festival, you know.
I remember back in those days, there was Rock the Vote, and all the, you know, we'll get kids involved and we'll get them politicized, and on these festival tours, that's one of the reasons the Cannabis Action Network was on these tours and showing up at these concerts, was there was active support from the organizers and from the bands for these good progressive causes. And the has that waned at all? I was oddly enough just on the Lollapalooza website. It's coming up the end of, I guess it's the end of this month in Chicago, and Rock the Vote still exists. There's at least a little mention of them on the thing. But is that still a thing?
Well, you know who's doing great things? Headcount. If you're familiar with them, but, you know, they kind of urge people to go out and vote, and they kind of work with the concert audience, and they kind of come out of the Dead Fish scene. So now with the Dead and Company traveling around, you know, this new version of the Dead with John Mayer, you know, and going back to the Fare Thee Well shows last year, you know, the so-called final Grateful Dead shows, they, you know, actually contacted Normal, and I was sort of the liaison to Normal for this, because I know Andy Bernstein is one of the main guys at Headcount, and he contacted me about getting Normal involved, and they did get Normal involved in the concerts in California and in Chicago, where they have this area, you know, like they've had in the past, like Can and other Normal would do at other concerts, where you're in that, maybe you're by yourself, or there's two or three other tables, and here they have a little row of tables of nonprofits. So I'm not sure if it's been continuing with Normal being involved, you know, with this run, but I see them constantly referring to all the events that they do. So I think that's where it's really been funneled through Headcount. You know, if you have a good nonprofit that wants to kind of reach out to a given band, you know, Headcount may be doing it. So, you know, you should, you know, anybody listening, you know, should get in touch with Headcount.
That's good to know. That's good to know. And again, folks, KBOO Radio in Portland. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Doug McVeigh. His name is Steve Bloom. And Doug, what a coincidence. Steve's my board op. Hey. And we are talking about pot culture, celebrity stoners, marijuana activism, hemp. Oh, my heavens. So much good stuff. And you can still join us at 503-231-8187. Well, maybe. We're having a good chat, though. This is fun. I haven't talked to my friend. And again, full disclosure, I have written for Freedom Leaf magazine and for Celeb Stoner. Now, let's turn to, it's getting close to the top of the hour. Let's turn to a bit of the sad part. I was on the website, noticed the passing, an article you had noting the passing of Rob Wasserman. From the Wasserman Weir Band and other projects. Bass player, I believe.
Yeah, bass player. Well, you know, it's been a terrible year for, you know, rock and roll and pop and R&B deaths. And, you know, it's getting worse and worse because a lot of the great you know, stars who may have come up in, you know, the 60s and the 70s. They're aging into their 70s and some of them into their 80s. And, you know, we're going to lose them. And sadly, you know, I decided to chronicle this at the website, celebstoner.com. Just, you know, I just started last year, and every time somebody would pass, I would put up a kind of a short notice. And the notice, I do it just simply like Rob Wasserman, bands. He played in Rat Dog and Wasserman and Weir. He had his own solo thing, and he is a Grammy-nominated artist, and he played bass. He died on June 29th. His death right now is undisclosed what the cause of the death. He was 64 years old. And his distinction, and I always put in a distinction, won the Grammy Award with Bobby McFerrin in 1989 for Brothers, the song Brothers from the Duets album. So it's Bobby McFerrin doing like his wordless great stuff and Rob Wasserman playing bass. And he won a Grammy Award. They won a Grammy Award for that. But he's best known for his work in the Grateful Dead scene. You know, when he, you know, did, you know, and working specifically with Bob Weir. So it's on that side of things. It's not on the Jerry side, it's on the Bobby side. And you know, it's a loss because the guy's a pretty young guy. You know, 63, 64, what happened, you know? So we don't know yet, but something happened. You know, I don't know what was his physical problems, but he was pretty young to be going. I mean, I'm a little bit younger than that, but still, when you start seeing people at that age, you wonder, you know, you got to stay healthy.
Ah, tell me about it, my friend. Tell me about it. It's that time of life. Okay. Well, you know what? Let's bring in a caller. We've had a good chat. And let's see what Gregory has to say. Hello, Gregory.
Hi, good morning, Doug. Good morning, Steve. This is Gregory Dower, who used to write for High Times occasionally, and I've written for Celeb Stoner as well. Just happened to be visiting the Portland area, found out about this program this morning, and wanted to tune in and say happy 4th of July. And I just wanted to remind people that, you know, the things we did with hemp as far as promoting them in the 90s was, you know, as patriotic as it got, I think, in a lot of ways. We've really helped turn around people's impressions and helped bring about the renewal of this plant that's going to do so much for us in the future. So best wishes to both of you guys.
Hey, Greg, I'm so happy to hear you. You know, I knew your voice even before hearing you say it was Greg. It was so funny. I just knew that voice. Greg Dower interviewed Allen Ginsberg for High Times.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah.
Other interviews he did, magazine.
Allen Ginsberg and Dr. Andrew Weil and Tom Robbins, the novelist.
Mm-hmm. I was your editor.
You certainly were, Steve. Thanks for giving me the opportunity. And, again, thanks for bringing this message to so many people through your liaison and your interaction with different bands and getting this message out on the road.
Well, thank you, Greg. You're welcome to write for Freedom Leap, so anytime.
Well, thank you for the invite, Steve. Do appreciate it.
Okay. Hey, Doug, let me just, I think we're running down to our last 5 minutes or so. Let me just tell people about Freedom Leaf magazine.
Sure.
You know, I after I left High Times in 2007, I started celebstoner.com. I went on the web, and I had to learn kind of a new language of communicating, becoming a web publisher, and I was one of the first marijuana blogs out there. Now there are dozens or even hundreds. And in the last couple of years, I've moved over to another company called Freedom Leaf Inc., which is actually owned by Dick Cowan, who was the executive director of Normal in the 90s, where I met him then. It was just really coincidental that I actually ended up at Freedom Leaf. I really didn't specifically have anything to do with Dick other than me knowing Dick, but his partner, Cliff Perry, and Chris Goldstein, who was the editor, senior editor at the time when I jumped aboard, they encouraged me to get involved. And I had met Cliff through Chris, and I took over the magazine on the third issue. We're now completing our 16th, going into number 17th, and I'm enjoying it. It's a great magazine. It's all about activism, politics, science, culture, arts, but really zeroing on the issues. Our next issue is going to be medical marijuana at the crossroads, you know, looking at what you mentioned earlier in our conversation. Where does medical marijuana fit in the world of adult use marijuana? You know, is there a place for it, or is it all going to be merged into one, you know, way of providing it and making it available, retail and wholesale. So we're discussing the big issues, and it's a good opportunity for me to do that. It's kind of what I used to do at High Times, a little bit minus the growing and more, you know, serious stuff, and, you know, try to get good interviews and good writers. And, you know, there's a lot of good people out there, and we're kind of bringing more and more of the quality writers into the magazine every day. So I encourage people to go to freedomleaf.com and take a look at our website. And also, we have the magazine up digitally. Look at the, you know, the issues on the menu bar. And the magazine's a print publication, so it gets distributed at stores, dispensaries, legal stores in the legal states, and also through normal chapters and SSDP chapters and Women Grow chapters. So if you do want to help us distribute our magazine, reach out to us at freedomleaf.com and take a look at Freedom Leaf.
All right, and that is the top of our hour. I got to thank our guest, Steve Bloom. Steve, thank you so much for being with us today. Steve Bloom is Leb Stoner and Freedom Leaf. I am Doug McVeigh, sitting in for our regular hosts, Cecil and Celeste, who will be back next week. This is More Talk Radio on KBOO Radio in 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. Thank you so much for being with us. Have a great 4th of July.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of One Flaming Arrow Intertribal Film Festival 2016, bringing Native American and Indigenous independent film to Portland, Oregon, July 28th through the 31st. Opening night at Clinton Street Theater, with showings through the weekend at Hollywood Theater and Rainmaker Gallery. Please consider supporting independent media. More information can be found at oneflamingarrow.com.
You are listening to the KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. The KBOO Evening News produces a one-hour newscast every weeknight. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training in writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge, but you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. Email Lisa Loving at newsdirector@kboo.org.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO.